Welcome to That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by Scientific Triathlon and hosted by me, Michael Eriksson. With me again today in the co-hosting chair is Jack Hutchins. Jack, you look like you've been out training. So how are you doing and what was on the schedule for today?
Hey, Michael, thanks for having me again. Yeah, I've just been for a little run. It's actually my kind of rest or recovery day today, active recovery day, I would say. So just three and a half K swim this morning and a 90-minute super easy jog that I just did then. So yeah, feeling a bit tired, but nice to keep the body moving. What about you? How's your day going?
Pretty good. Yeah, I did a bit of a tempo run. I did 3x16 minutes at marathon pace with nice. 4 minutes rest. So that was, I've been during the early stages of the winter, I was doing more VO2 and threshold focused work. And now the intensity is slowly coming down and the durations of the intervals are getting longer as some races are approaching. I'm actually only two and a half weeks away from a 40K trail race. So maybe I'll update the listeners on that after that's done in the final weekend of the month. But yeah, it's a good day. Good day. And excited to chat about today's main topic, which is Ironman training. How are you feeling about this chat?
I have to ask, what is marathon pace?
Marathon pace is about 350 per K. So that's like 240, 41, 242, I think, right now. So my next marathon, which we talked about a little bit, I hope to go sub 240, but I don't have a marathon on the schedule yet. I need to register for one and it will likely be the end of the year. So I hope that it will be a bit quicker by then, maybe getting down to 345 per K or at least something like 347, 348.
Nice. Yeah, that's some serious running there. I don't know if you saw the half marathon world record.
Oh, yeah.
The record is broken just down the road from us. So, yeah.
I did see that. Yeah, that is absolutely... I think the previous record was also in the Lisbon half marathon, wasn't it? But by Kiplimo as well.
Yeah, he had an unofficial world record at Barcelona last year.
Okay.
It was deemed not allowed because the pace car was too close to him, so it was deemed drafting, which is a bit of an odd one for me because he wasn't disqualified, right? It was still allowed. He still had the prize money and everything, and the result and time is still actually on World Athletics, but it's just they couldn't ratify it as a world record. So it's kind of is it a result or is it not a result, you know?
Well, I guess it's a result, but they have the ratification for a world record is more specific than just a result. Just like Boston Marathon can't be a world record because of the net downhill, and I think also they have the point to point that the start and the finish have to be within a certain distance, don't they? I'm sure lots of listeners are now screaming at me for not knowing this in more detail, what the exact ratification is.
Me though, by the sounds of it. So yeah, that makes sense.
There's definitely that net downhill is one of the reasons that Boston Marathon, even a world record time there, would not be ratified as an official world record. So that's at least one of the things. But yeah, no, that was insane. I think I had to put his time into a pace calculator, and I think it was it 243 Ks that he was running. So that is absolutely mind-boggling.
Yeah, that is some serious running. It's like 64-second laps, which is, yeah, nuts. I guess it's unusual to be retrospectively kind of unverified though, right? But yeah.
Yeah.
But no, Ironman chat today is going to be a good one. Yeah. So should we get into it?
Let's get into it. Maybe let's start with who can or should do an Ironman. So with that, what I'm thinking about is, what are the prerequisites? How fit should you be? How long should you have been in triathlon or in endurance sports? What are your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I mean, I actually went down a bit of a rabbit hole on this one because I wanted to say that anyone could do one. And then I was thinking, well, actually, you need to be able to swim and ride a bike, right? So there are some probably very basic prerequisites. And I think it's amazing what the human body can do with enough time. So honestly, for most people with enough motivation, it's probably not whether or not they could do one. It's how long it would take to prepare for it, right? But to give some more simple, basic kind of general rules of thumb, I'd say you'd have to have a an active background and kind of have exercised relatively regularly for a number of years. And ideally, you maybe have done a sprint triathlon or an Olympic triathlon even before thinking about putting a date in the diary to do an Ironman, right?
Yeah, I think those are, yeah, I agree with that by and large. I think another factor that I would also consider is how committed are you willing to be in your preparation? Because if you are going to dedicate yourself to training every day, or let's say 6 days a week, and maybe some days you're going to do two sessions, then you can do it much quicker than somebody who is a bit more, let's say, flexible or slightly less committed, slightly less dedicated, and are going to, some weeks are going to train 6-7 times, but some weeks it's going to be 3 or 4 times. So if you're starting from maybe having run a few 5Ks and 10Ks, so you're a recreational jogger or something like that, I think that that's a pretty, yeah, I mean, it's not uncommon to see people then decide to either go and run a marathon, obviously, but also do an Ironman. Then if you're going to be super motivated and train quite a lot, obviously without, then the caveat to that is that you can't overdo it either. But if you're going to be dedicated, then you can do it more quickly than somebody who is going to be training 3 or 4 times a week. You can still get there by training less frequently with less consistency, but it will take longer to build up that fitness. I think that that's another factor as well. And when we're talking about people that are going from not having done a triathlon, perhaps maybe just having done some of the other sports and going to do an Ironman in let's say 6 months, then yes, it's possible. But I think that it's also important to be aware of the dedication to training that those 6 months are going to require. So for a lot of people, it might make more sense to put one in the diary if you're coming from that background for not this year, but put a 713 for this year and then next year go to an Ironman. For me, generally, that's what I advise people to do. Don't do an Ironman in your first year of doing triathlon. Do a 713 or a half distance, and then next year go for an Ironman. That I think is a good trajectory that also makes sure in some way that you don't overdo it psychologically as much as anything. But it's absolutely possible to do one more quickly.
Yeah, no, I like that. I agree with that. I think just to kind of follow up there, it's almost more the psychological prerequisites are more important than the physical, right? In that you're going to accept that it's gonna take a long time. And if you're prepared to do that and to accept that it's not gonna be a linear progression, that you're gonna fail, there's gonna be times when things are going to go maybe backwards, but then it is possible. Anything is possible. Should be on the Ironman payroll for getting that slogan in there.
Yeah.
Guess we'll get into as well if it's looking to just complete or versus perform, because those are, again, two probably quite different timelines.
Yeah, well, if you're looking to perform, then that depends on what the performance is for you. Like, if you've done a 7.3, then you can prepare for an Ironman in, let's say, 12 weeks or so. It's a good amount of time to have specific preparation for an Ironman, and that wouldn't even be 12 weeks for me of really, really specific. It would be maybe 6 weeks of, yeah, getting in the long, some long work, some good hours, but then intensities are still a bit higher and lower than the Ironman pace, and then in the final 6 weeks you would just narrow in on that Ironman pace, roughly speaking. Or it might be, it's not exactly 12 weeks, it could be 14 weeks or it could be 10 weeks. But if you've done a 7.3, then I think you're basically ready to do a focused Ironman program. But yeah, how well you're going to perform in an Ironman is ultimately going to depend on what your base is. And because in any given 12-week or 24-week or however long your period is, there's only so much you can improve in a certain number of time. And that's going to, so you're always going to be dependent on what is your base when you're starting your training program. But let's maybe dig into the specific demands of the event for an Ironman. And we can maybe also highlight how it contrasts with some of the shorter distances. So what would you say are the most important demands of an Ironman?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long day out, right? So it's going to take anywhere from, well, I guess 7.5 hours for the top pros to, you know, I don't know what the cutoff is exactly.
17, sometimes 16, but 17 usually.
Yeah, so yeah, I guess that's for the completion. When I'm referring to someone who's trying to perform, they have a specific time or result that's not just make the cutoff time. And yeah, it's basically very much an aerobic event, right? So we have a massive reliance on the kind of aerobic system, your ability to sustain that kind of sub threshold, sub LT1, mostly intensity for hours and for all day. So it's very much an energy management kind of requirement. And yeah, there's obviously fueling demands and pacing and also probably more importantly on the back end of the run, it's just general muscular conditioning and durability as well. And it requires a lot in all of those kind of aspects. Yeah, I guess.
And I would add the muscular resilience on the bike as well is going to play into your how you run. Because for quite a lot of people that haven't built up that base on the bike, not just the metabolic and cardiovascular base, but the muscular endurance, then that bike can take a lot out of you for the run, as a lot of people are aware of. And so it's not just the muscular endurance on the run, even though that's definitely the most pronounced. And yeah, it's just a really good endurance base is the main thing. And if you have that, you're also likely to have built up decent economy, because that tends to correlate well with lifetime volume. So that's I think that's the thing, that the economy is quite crucial, which is why lifetime volume is such an important factor in Ironman, and why we see even at the pro level, people are reaching their peak at mid-30s over the Ironman distance, whereas in the shorter distances in 703 and shorter, where it's more threshold dominant, then that peak tends to come quite a bit sooner.
Yeah, no, yeah, for sure, I agree with all that.
What would you say are there any important things that people should think about when it comes to selecting a race, an Ironman race? Like, does it matter? Is it just the one that you think looks fun to do, or are there other factors to consider?
Yes, I mean, I guess cooler climates, faster rolling roads, and simpler courses do tend to make things easier. I think there is a limit to that, and a dead flat, boring bike course can make things a little bit harder mentally. And also, some people say that a slightly rolling run course can shift the load from different muscle groups and actually make things a little easier. I know Patrick Langer kind of has said that he runs faster on slightly rolling courses. But yeah, I mean, that's if you're looking to complete, then I would be looking for an easy course that probably ticks a lot of those boxes, because if it's already going to be a kind of a bit touch and go to make the cutoff times, then considering those factors is definitely going to make things easier for yourself, right? And I was thinking, what is the kind of one of the easiest, you know, quote unquote Ironman courses to do, or full distance courses, and I feel like Challenge Rough tends to be ticking a lot of those boxes as quite a nice, you know, super fast rolling roads. It's almost always a wetsuit, although this last year was an exception to that. And yeah, people tend to be pushing fast times there. Obviously, the logistics and there's a lot of other stuff that go into it as well. Do you have any thoughts there?
Yeah, I think the Challenge Rough one, I mean, biased because I had one athlete who really struggled with the non-wetsuit swim there. And obviously it's fresh water, so which makes it even harder. So that actually becomes a potential challenge. But as you said, it's not many years that it is for age groupers, a non-wetsuit swim, although for pros it is. But the bike definitely ticks those boxes, I think. And the run may, generally, yes, although rough can be very hot some years. So that's maybe one thing also when it comes to the race to consider, not just the terrain, but, well, you said cooler weather. So I mean, one thing maybe to look for, especially if you are struggling in the swim more so, is to look for a swim course that is definitely going to be wetsuit legal, and potentially even something like a harbor or bay swim where you're not going to have to deal with the elements of the sea, but you're going to get the buoyancy effect of the sea. That can be helpful. So, and then also, yeah, really looking for cooler, almost guaranteed cooler climates. That's something that I would consider. I don't have any course in mind right now that tick those boxes necessarily, but those are all things to consider. Obviously, if you swim really well, then that's not necessarily an issue. But I think that, yeah, that's for completion. I think that those are the main things. And one more thing actually is that pick a race that excites you, that gets you motivated to go out and train, because that's going to be the main thing, to get out the door and get training that drives your ability to then complete the race on race day. Because if you haven't done the training, it doesn't matter how fast the course is. It's going to be hard anyway. If the goal is performance, then I would think about choosing a course that maximizes your strengths. So if you're a strong swimmer, then choose a swim that is generally very challenging and perhaps slow, like a sea swim, maybe a swim with currents, and not downriver currents, but proper currents. Basically, any slow swim, maybe a swim that is likely to be non-wetsuit. Obviously, Kona is a good example there. On the bike, if you're strong on the bike, then you have to really think about, where are your strengths? Is it watts per kg for long climbs? Is it watts per CDA for flat, fast courses? Or is it that you're quite good at more punchy riding, so you want to have some kind of rolling hills? So think about that, what suits you there. And if you're strong on the run, then I would say generally a slightly more hilly and challenging run, maybe one that gets you out of your rhythm a bit, because I think weaker runners struggle more with that than stronger runners. So for performance, you have to think about it, from the perspective of what are your biggest strengths, and try to choose a course that really maximizes those strengths.
Yeah, no, for sure. And yeah, I think the final point would maybe be logistics and travel and time zones and that sort of thing as well, right? Because you shouldn't overlook how much of an impact that can have in the final, week on the lead up to a race. So yeah.
Agreed. So how would you generally think about periodization of training into an Ironman?
I mean, yeah, so across the year, I would unfortunately say that more is almost always better. And when I say across the year, I'm saying about the total work that we can get in rather than what we can maximize for a few weeks here and there. So I'm kind of always having that in the back of my mind when periodizing. Ironman is all about efficiency. So if in the early season you can start with a more technical phase, you can invest more time on improving economy, then that tends to pay dividends. And then really I would transfer from there to a more traditional base phase, where the focus is perhaps more on volume rather than even anything else, with slightly less of an emphasis on kind of even threshold of VO2 work in the base phase. That being said, when the athlete is ready, so this, typically would be kind of 6 months out or so, I like to do some intensity and a VO2 max block or two to raise the ceiling, and then kind of reverse periodize from there towards the specific phase with a threshold block to bring up the thresholds close to the VO2 max and bring up the LT1 and then transition into a specific phase. So it's not that dissimilar to a kind of 70.3 block, but as I said, it's just I'm more focused on the volume and how we can maximize the total hours and kilojoules over the year than I would be in a 70.3. And that even goes outside of the specific period there. But that being said, it's going back to a last episode that we did on profiling, there's always going to be focus on intensity and making sure that intensity is still geared towards what that individual athlete needs and where their strengths and weaknesses lie. But I'm interested to hear your thoughts. How do you approach this for an IMA?
Yeah, so it would be, I mean, you could call it reverse periodization largely, I think. So quite kind of similar to you, I'm depending on the athlete, they may or may not do like a proper base block before starting with some intensity. I just find that in practice, it's hard for athletes living in colder climates with short, without a lot of daylight to really get in the hours when you actually, when that period would fall. So in practice, it ends up being often kind of a pure reverse periodization, starting with a bit more. I agree, you always try to maximize volume within the constraints that you have, but then intensity-wise, funneling it from higher intensity towards lower intensities as you get closer to the race. So from less specific to more specific training. And where I think it gets really important is those two, or where things get really, really critical in your preparation is when you're about 12 to 14 weeks out from the Ironman is when I would start with like volume would already be going up significantly. You might not be doing the long rides and long runs. You wouldn't be doing 5-hour rides every week necessarily at this point, but you would be building up towards that and you would certainly be doing some decent long runs and long rides. Intensity at first would be maybe not, it would not be Ironman intensity the first 6 weeks of that period, but it would be maybe slightly higher and slightly lower. So you might be doing long rides that have no specific intensity, and you might be doing some tempo work, so slightly higher than Ironman intensity, like marathon pace, like the session that I did today on the run, as I talked about. That would be a good session to do when you're about starting from 12, 14 weeks out. And then as you get to those final 6 to 8 weeks out is when I would really focus heavily on the Ironman specific work, which tends to be around LT1 for a lot of people. If you're more towards that completion rather than competing, then it would be even below LT1 for sure. And even if you have performance goals, but your goal might be let's say above 12 hours or so, then we might already be talking about, you're going to be a fair bit below LT1 in most cases just because the duration is so long. But the principle still stands then that you would go from less specific to more specific within that period. And which means that, volume would be coming up, but intensity would be going down. But obviously, as the intensity goes down towards race pace, you would do longer blocks of it within, and you would do it within those long workouts as you get to those final 6 to 8 weeks. So a 5-hour ride might have 3 by 1 hour at Ironman pace. It tends to be a sort of a peak bike ride that I would give athletes. And that's in a nutshell how my periodization would look like.
Yeah. When we're talking about completion athletes, their Ironman pace is not going to be far from their kind of easy endurance training, right? So their LT1 is also not going to be far from that as well. So how do you approach that in terms of specificity when they're already arguably doing specific work from day one with easy work?
Yeah, great question. I think that's just a question then of gradually building up the volume. So and I would still maybe in that pre-specific period, so let's say from 14 weeks out to 6-8 weeks out, you have that 6 to 8 week block that is the pre-specific block or the supportive block, where I would probably still do some tempo work with these athletes, so some solid aerobic stimulus but nothing too high intensity, because for this cohort of athletes, I think that's less useful anyway. Like they're already getting a strong stimulus by just going a bit harder, like zone 3 in a 5-zone model. So, but yeah, by and large, it just becomes about starting from day one. You're thinking about what is the volume of that I need to be doing on my long run, my long bike when I'm 4 weeks out from the race, and trying to gradually build up from there. So that's basically what I would prioritize there.
Yeah, nice. No, I agree with that. And what does the specific period look like for you?
So if we're talking about that really specific period, those 6 to 8 weeks, and there I would include the taper, which would be 2 weeks for me, then it would basically be the overall volume during the week is important, but it wouldn't necessarily be so much more important than for any given race. But what is important is, of course, the long sessions, the long swim, the long bike, the long run. And in those sessions, you would pretty much always be doing Ironman intensity. Sometimes there would be some mixed intensities, like a preset of slightly higher intensity or post set of slightly higher intensity. But the main meat and potatoes of the session would be that Ironman specificity. So, typical weekend would be a long ride on one day and potentially a brick run off it. And a Sunday would be a long run, or it can be the other way around. In some cases, if an athlete has a weakness on the run, I often shift this and do the run on the Saturday to do the run on fresher legs, and try to get a bit more stimulus that way. So that depends. But yeah, anyway, you would typically have a long bike, long run, building up to something like what I said, the 5-hour ride with 3x1 hour at Ironman pace, and the recoveries would be. Doesn't really matter, wouldn't make them too long, but if it's 5 minutes or 10 minutes or even 15 minutes, I'm not too bothered, because also the recoveries shouldn't be just like super easy spinning. They should still be like, you're not going down to 40% of FTP. You might still be at 55, 60% of FTP in them. So, 3x1 hour within a 5-hour ride would be, and some athletes would definitely go longer than 5 hours, at least in certain rides, but maybe not necessarily, not the vast majority of athletes, I don't think. And the run, I would tend to build up to two and a half hours roughly for the peak run for many athletes is roughly where I would go. And there you would have, again, Ironman specific intervals, but they would be, instead of being 40 to 60 minutes long, they might be 20 to 30 minutes long. So you might be doing something like 3x30 minutes of Ironman pace within a 2.5 hour run as a peak session. And the swim, I tend to just give a 3.8K swim at Ironman race pace as the key session, which I know you're making a face there for the people not watching. This is not for pro athletes, but for age group athletes, where I think that's it's less taxing because the relative intensity is so much lower at Ironman. It's basically just a 3.8K continuous swim for most people. It's not even going to be that hard if you don't find completing the swim as a continuous set hard, in a way.
Yeah, and it's great for kind of mental resilience, right? That's just getting you used to being in the water for that long with your head, with your head towards, without any distractions.
So. Yeah, and checking the equipment, checking that your tri-suit isn't restricting your mobility when you're swimming continuously and those sorts of things, and the wetsuit as well. But what about you? What are the key aspects of your specific period?
Yeah, I mean, very similar. I guess the long runs carry kind of a high injury risk, right? So it's not to say that I don't do them outside of the specific period, especially, you know, with some athletes, we're doing quite long runs all year round. But for the majority of the long kind of aerobic adaptations that I'm looking for, we're getting on the bike outside of that specific period. Whereas once we get into that specific period, that's where we need to be getting the conditioning for the marathon and into the legs and the body. And earlier on in the specific period, I like to alternate on the run between maximizing duration in the long runs and then alternating with a slightly shorter long run, but with some race specific intensity, maybe above and below Ironman pace. And then as we get closer to race day, they're kind of combining. So we have the duration and the intensity in the one session. And then similar to as you said, with the bricks and simulation sessions, I like to do the kind of Ironman distance over the course of a weekend. And there's various different makeups that I use. But a nice one is to have an Ironman specific swim on the Saturday morning, say 10x400s, and then a long ride with some Ironman intensity, 3x1 hour, for example, 5 hours total. And then on the Sunday, a bike to run brick with a shorter bike in the morning, just to kind of load the legs with some Ironman intensity in there. And then a long run off the bike with, again, some Ironman pace. And that's a super tough weekend, but I like to use that once or twice in towards the back end of the specific build up there. And yeah, I mean, I guess the one big thing is that it does actually work quite well to be a weekend warrior, right? With Ironman training in the specific period in that.
Yeah, it does.
You're going to have to get the body used to doing a lot of volume, a lot of load in the 1 or 2 days, because that's what we're preparing for on race day. And often that's what works best with someone's schedule anyway. So yeah, you get in more intensive work that we maybe still need to do during the week, and then loading up the weekends with not necessarily as big of a simulation session as what I just described, but definitely that's where we're getting the volume, and we really can double down on the volume there. And I think just overall is to say, over the year, we're looking at consistency over time, right? So we have to make sure that it's not super taxing, and we're considering the family and the life balance more so than the training. But this specific period is maybe where you can start to make a few more compromises there and say, and negotiate with the rest of your life commitments that actually this is where it comes down to it, and it's worthwhile if you can to make a bit more sacrifice at that time.
Yeah, and especially if you have performance goals, you're going to have to do that. There's no such thing as you can't just set a goal and then not do the work to achieve it. And when the goal has something to do with Ironman, it is going to take a lot of work to achieve it. I'm curious, because you talked about the brick session there within the simulation weekend. Are bricks something that you do outside of those simulation sessions as well in the preparation for an Ironman? How do you see the role of brick sessions?
Yeah, it depends on the athlete, honestly. If it's a big limitation that they feel they need that specific to experience that feeling a little more often, then I will use them from a bit further out and a bit more consistently in the kind of macro cycle or year. But for most of the time, I would prioritize execution and quality of each individual session over doing a brick session where it's potentially going to be slightly less quality and the recovery off the back of it is more intense and more severe. So we're going to need to then make more compromises, not just for the sessions on that day, but the days following. But yeah, it definitely has its place. And typically I'm only using anywhere between 2 to 8 brick sessions with most athletes. Do you use them any more or less?
For me, the Ironman is the event where I find brick sessions much more valuable than the other, the shorter distances. Because in the shorter distances, like you said, you're giving up something in terms of how well you can execute the run. You're going to be tired. And whether it's a 7.3 where you're running pace is somewhere similar to your marathon, your open marathon pace probably. So it's that kind of zone 3 tempo. And in Olympic and sprint distance, you're talking about sort of lower to upper threshold respectively. Then those are really all quality run sessions. And I don't like the idea of, I think it's an opportunity cost to do a lot of bricks, race specific bricks, where you're just giving up some pace, you're giving up probably also some volume of intensity by doing them as bricks instead of doing them as standalone. I don't think that logic applies as much to the Ironman, because the intensity is lower. So you're not giving up tempo run or a threshold run, but you're basically just adding aerobic volume. And if you're doing them at race pace, then it's still around LT1. So I find them more useful for the Ironman than for the other distances. And whether I use them then comes down to other factors, such as it can also be a bit risky, especially if I know the athlete isn't so good at fueling. Then I don't want to overdo it with bricks, because to start a run on low glycogen, if you do that repeatedly, that's a bit of a risky situation. But if the athlete is good at fueling, then I'm quite happy to do brick sessions very regularly throughout those final 12 weeks or so. And not all of them have to be big big runs with a lot of race pace, but it can be anything from just doing a 30-minute jog after the bike to doing something like a 75-minute run with 3x15 minutes at Ironman race pace, or even more. Like, there's definitely cases where I give a 60-minute straight race pace run, but that would be more of a, like, one of those just a couple, two, three, like, bigger sessions that, yeah, at most two or three of those typically. So, but to do just generally running off the bike and including a little bit of LT1 work, I find, yeah, a lot of athletes can tolerate that reasonably well. And it's useful for not so much for learning to run off the bike, because I'm doubtful that that's a thing, but maybe it's a little bit of a thing, but I don't think it's a big thing. But what I find more useful is that it helps you really assess your pacing on the run, but also whether you paced it correctly on the bike and whether you fueled and hydrated correctly on the bike. So it gives you lots of opportunities to really validate your bike pacing and your bike fueling and hydration strategy, which is one of the big benefits for me of using brick workouts for the Ironman. So I'm quite a fan there, even though I'm quite almost the opposite of a fan for the other distances.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I guess, I mean, across the distances, it's still within triathlon more of a strength-based run, right? And so you could put that same argument, I guess, to the shorter distances a little bit. But yeah, I guess you look at Olympic distance athletes, right? And they're doing a lot of kind of bike run, even the multiple bike run rep sessions. So I think
are they though? Some of them are, but a lot of them are not. Like,
more than
who are you thinking about?
Well, a lot of the British
okay
performance centers do,
yeah,
do a lot of those sessions.
Yeah
I mean,
I'm thinking of the international squads, the Joel Filial and Paulo Sousa, and mm-hmm. I think that they do significantly less of that.
Mm.
I don't want to speak for them, obviously, but
yeah I guess elite kind of short course guys as well, it's probably different for others because of the get out speed is so important. But yeah, I mean, it's always a balance though, right? Because even Ironman bricks, there, yes, the pace is lower, but then the volumes tends to be higher, so it's so hard to get enough fuel in and to make sure that you can recover off the
back. Yeah, I think my argument is that let's say a 1 hour zone two run off the bike, it just replaces an endurance run you would have done anyway. You're just doing it off the bike. Whereas if you do that for a 7.3, you're doing, you know, a tempo run off the bike. Mm. It kind of replaces one of your opportunities to do another quality run. Mm. So if you were going to do two intense sessions during the week, now you're only doing one other intense session plus the brick, because you're not going to do the two intense sessions and a brick with tempo work. That's just going to be way too much. But then the session that you replaced with a brick would probably have been a lot better than the brick session that you did. That's my point with why it makes more sense for me with Ironman.
Yeah, no, I guess that makes sense. I guess then the compromise I would make is reducing the volume of the brick if it's a shorter distance event, right? So if you did 15, 20 minutes worth of work at 70.3 pace, that's still not that much more than an hour endurance run, or maybe not endurance run, but an hour Ironman pace is not that dissimilar. But yeah, I guess we're slightly disagreeing here, which is good.
That's good. That's good. Yeah.
So, other considerations for Ironman? What about heat preparation for Kona?
Yeah. I think this is probably something worth its own episode at some point. But yeah, if you're going to race in hot conditions, I think that's definitely important. But for Kona, especially for athletes traveling farther, then you need to arrive there. If you want to perform, then when you're going to Kona, some athletes do go there just to, the performance goal is in the qualifying race, and then Kona is more of a victory lap. I've had quite a few people in that situation. Mm-hmm. But if your goal is to perform, you need to arrive there early enough anyway, so you can do quite a bit of the heat prep there. And we know from science that just a pure, we're not talking about maximizing hemoglobin mass or anything, but the pure heat prep you can get relatively quickly in about 2 weeks or 10 specific sessions. So if you arrive in Kona 10 days before and you've done a few, like in the week before you go out there, you've done a few heat sessions, then that's probably going to get you pretty long way there. I do think that doing simulation heat sessions at home, unless you have to go really far in how hard and how uncomfortable it is to be able to anywhere near simulate how brutal and miserable it is when you get to conditions like Kona or some of the Asian races like Malaysia, or that's the one that comes to mind. There are probably some other ones as well that have similar conditions. But yeah, it's if you do a sort of an average heat preparation block at home and then you get to Kona 4 days before the race, then that you're going to be at a disadvantage. So you have to really kind of push it quite hard with the heat prep to be able to make up for the fact that you're just spending a few days in the actual real environment. I think it's not worth it to go into too much detail there, but I think for those sorts of climates, you absolutely need to do heat prep at least if you have performance goals. There's no getting around that, because it's so easy to otherwise just have a DNF or walk a big part of the run. But do you have, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I agree. I was going to say, like, in order to get the adaptations at home, you really have to, for me, I've done heat blocks at home where I've wrapped up and on the turbo without the fan and stuff, and thought that I was getting a kind of enough of a stimulus. But then actually I did a block in Loughborough in the heat chamber there, and I realized that I just wasn't getting hot enough. I was not doing enough to get that stimulus. But then, so if you do get that stimulus, it's taking so much out of you that it's really something you need to be careful with. And I've definitely got it wrong with athletes before. And I think it's why you're seeing a lot of elite athletes now, because I think post Tokyo or the last, 5 years or so, it's obviously been shown to have these great physiological benefits. So then people have been loading up with heat work. But it's now, I think, a lot of elites are realizing that you need to be very careful with how much you use it and when you use it. And most people only really have one good heat block a year in them. Otherwise, the training over the year is going to be compromised too much, that it's not going to make up for the lack of form that they're able to gain from training effectively.
Yeah. What about tapering into an Ironman? How do you approach that?
Yeah, I mean, if all things are going well, then I like to have some. Yeah, if all things are going well, then I like to reduce the volume and at least 2 weeks out, really, we're starting to think about recovery as more of a focus. That two weeks away from race day, I like to have the last kind of big brick and simulation workout sessions. And then off the back of that, I like to really make sure that there's a pure recovery focus, really. So then once we go into the week of the race, the athlete's already feeling relatively fresh, and we can start to do some kind of prep sessions, some openers, and kind of get the body ready and tuned up to race again on that last week. But in terms of volume, we're looking really 75% of peak volume for that second week out, and then race week is even 50% or less. On that kind of week. Yeah. How do you approach it?
Yeah, I'm looking at my notes here and I wrote 80% and 60%. But I think it depends on what your starting volume is. I would say the same if your starting volume is quite high, 75, 50 is more like it. And if your starting volume is a bit lower, then it's more like 80 to 60, or it could even be 80, 85, 65. So it does depend a bit, but it gives you, as a listener, directional information about how to shape that volume reduction. And yeah, I do very similarly with the 2 weeks. I think I do what you do in race week also in that penultimate week. So start that week really easy, but then build into that week a little bit to a bit of a, like, some taper workouts the weekend before. And then the same thing again in race week, even though there the key activation workouts would be more midweek around Thursday, most likely Wednesday. Thursday is very common because a lot of athletes travel out on Wednesday or Tuesday for a Sunday race. So Thursday would be the most common one for a Sunday race that I would give the activation workouts. But it could be Sunday, it could be Friday even. But then they would be definitely a bit smaller, and it's not as if they're big anyway. But yeah, that's basically it. And I think in the intensity that I give those weeks, I would not give only Ironman pace. I would give a little bit of tempo threshold work as well to add a bit of sharpness, add a little bit of peaking, if that's the right way to describe it. So I do think that makes the athletes feel better on race day when they've done a little bit of higher intensity after mainly. It's not as if we haven't done any other intensity than Ironman intensity in the specific block, but that's been very much dominant. So I think adding a bit, proportionally a little bit more of that compared to the Ironman pace in the taper period seems to work quite well.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one, right? Because the activation sessions or prep sessions, we're not doing a 5K or a sprint distance, right? So I'm always conscious of making sure that you're feeling good and ready to go, but at the same time, not overdoing it so they're kind of too riled up and the muscle tension is increased and they're, you know, because they're fresh at this point. So it's easy for those sessions to go out and push in big numbers. And really that's going to shift the profile and in the wrong direction a little bit. And yeah, how do you manage those sessions and what typically are you prescribing for those?
Well, I think as long as you stay below threshold or at or below threshold, I don't see a too big a problem with that. So generally those sessions would be something like, you might, for example, on the bike, you might start an activation session with 5 minutes around 90%, and then you would do three more five minute intervals at Ironman pace. So it's just that first interval is a bit faster, or it could even be the last one. So, and similarly on the run. So it's still sub threshold, or at most or on the swim, maybe some threshold work there, but not going much higher than that. And also limiting the total amount so that it's actually, it should not be a hard effort. It should be, because at 90% of FTP or critical power, you could hold that intensity for a long time, but you're only doing it for 5 minutes in this example. So, for me, it's a lot about just feeling good biomechanically and feeling a good flow, and I think psychologically as well. So, but yeah, I do agree it's much less important than for something like a sprint distance or anything that is shorter than Ironman. It's maybe more psychological than anything. Yeah. But I think if you feel good in those sessions, then it's not a bad thing. But you do have to be a bit careful with how you structure them because you don't want to shift completely to. But that's also why maybe with the Ironman, depends on your starting volume. But I've kind of gone a bit back. I used to probably reduce volume a bit more than I do now. There are still examples of people that reduce it a whole lot less, basically not reducing it at all, which I don't really agree with, especially for age groupers. But I probably reduce volume a little bit less than I used to do because I think that once the body is kind of in that, it's found a really sort of diesel state you don't want to get out of that necessarily before the race. So it's okay if you not necessarily feel tired, but the body is carrying a tiny bit of fatigue still. You don't have to shed all of that necessarily because it's important as well to maintain those aerobic adaptations. And you do have to do some volume to do that. That's more important than the intensity that you're doing. So that's maybe a small shift that I've done in the last couple of years compared to how I used to do things.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm not prescribing the Norwegian full, what was it, 38K run, 6 days up, but it's definitely important to maintain some volume, and it keeps the kind of blood volume and aerobic conditioning up going into race day.
Yeah, definitely. What about nutrition and hydration? What are your thoughts around that? How is that incorporated into the training and the preparation?
Yeah, I mean, fueling is critical, right, for for a full distance. And if we're talking about the fuel we're taking in on race day, I'm looking at those race simulation weekend brick sessions are the key times when we're practicing and dialing in exactly what we're going to take on race day in terms of amount of carbs, amount of fluids, electrolyte content, and that sort of stuff. Obviously, the considerations need to be altered based on the conditions of race day and training. But ideally, we're getting things as close as we can to that race day, race plan. But before that, it's also about using the longer sessions and training in general to train the gut and train the absorption rate, right? So there's a lot of evidence now showing that the gut is easily, not necessarily super easy, but it's easy to increase the absorption rate of carbohydrates there. So it's important to be pushing how much you can take per hour in those key sessions from sort of 10 weeks out. I like to start and really see if we can start to push the numbers up. And also experiment with the type of fuel as well. Obviously, I prefer using the precision fuel and hydration products. I think they go down the easiest for me, and that's what I would always recommend. And it's making sure that athletes are happy with what they're taking as well.
Yeah, I didn't do an ad read before. I was going to put in one of my pre-recorded ones, but we might as well go into that now. So Precision Fuel Hydration, as you mentioned, they're the sponsor for today's episode. And one thing that I think that they do exceptionally well for the Ironman specifically is their Flow Gel. So for listeners that are not aware, that's a massive gel that has 300 grams of carbs in it. And it's a bit more liquidy than typical gels or than their normal gels anyway. And basically, that's a replacement for what a lot of people used to do, me included. I used to take a bunch of precision fuel gels, the 90 gram gels, and mix them into one bottle or two bottles for an Ironman, and then just have the fuel in my bottles. It's easy that way, but then you end up with some issues there, that some of the gel then ends up just basically getting stuck at the bottom of the bottle and it doesn't mix perfectly. So the Flow Gel is the solution to that problem because it's already pre-made to be that replacement for that gel plus water mix that we used to do. It's purpose made for being drunk right out of the bottle or through a straw. So I think that's for the Ironman bike. It's a perfect product. And yeah, if you're going to do an Ironman, I would recommend trying that. I'm a big fan of the Flow Gel. So check it out on precisionfuelhydration.com. And remember that as a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order with the code TTS2026. Yeah, I think I don't really have anything to add on nutrition. So, and I think we're already at quite far time-wise, given that I have a meeting in about 20 minutes. I want to get to common mistakes to avoid. What would you say are the most common mistakes that you see people making or that you think people make in Ironman training?
Yeah, good question. I think that too much intensity is often an easy trap to fall into. It, as I said at the beginning, I think more is almost always better when it comes to Ironman training, and
more volume
is always better. So when you're creeping up intensity in a lot of sessions, in a lot of endurance sessions and also just threshold sessions or tempo sessions, when they start becoming more upper threshold or creeping above LT2, then it has an impact on how much you can get in terms of training duration. And that's is over the year the biggest key driver to performance and completion in Ironman, I would say. What about you?
Yeah, I wrote down four things. So number one is overtraining, doing more than you were ready for. And that I think is quite common, especially when we have people coming from not really having been triathletes for a long time, maybe having been runners or cyclists, not so much because cyclists tend to be used to doing good volume anyway. But yeah, even more being into things like strength for power sports or team sports. just doing too much too quickly. And that is why, even though it's possible to do an Ironman in a short time frame, like it requires some good precision if you don't have a strong background in endurance sport, if you don't have a good base, let's say. So doing more, and that applies to volume and intensity equally, too much too soon, and basically getting some level of overtraining or overreaching. Then the second one is more specifically ramping up the distance of your long run too much too quickly. I think there's some interesting research out quite recently about like how the ramp rate of your long run is more predictive of injuries than the ramp rate of your overall weekly volume in running. So yeah, being really structured and systematic with how you ramp up your long run, I think is important. Related to both of those previous points, actually, underfueling and again, especially with newer athletes that don't quite understand how important it is to fuel when you're doing high volume, like 6-8 hours can be high volume for somebody who's used to doing nowhere near that before. So obviously 7-8 hours is probably not what you're doing when you're in the thick of Ironman preparation, and you're doing much more than that. But yeah, underfueling is a big one. And then, yeah, I do agree with your point. I didn't have it on my list, but the thing I had on my list was that for more, let's say, for performance rather than for completion, I think that focusing too much on the specificity, and by that I mainly mean too long periods. You're starting already in January and February and doing a bunch of Ironman-specific work. I think that that's a mistake, because you're missing out on an opportunity there to build your general physiology, work on your weaknesses and just the general markers of performance in physiology. And then there's still plenty of time to I basically do the specificity closer to the Ironman, because it's different if you're training for a 70.3 or an Olympic distance, where the specificity is also quite relevant to general endurance performance because it's closer to threshold, which is important for many distances. But for Ironman, that it's such a long event that I think that's a mistake to start that too soon and do too long periods of specificity.
Yeah, nice. No, I agree with those. I would also add pacing as well is a common mistake. When it comes to race day, people not being realistic with powers they can hold and paces they can run, and even getting too hot on that the first 500 meters of the swim, and you know you've not got many matches to burn on Ironman.
So yeah. How do you advise people? How do you help them pace correctly and come up with their pacing plans?
Yeah, I mean, on the swim, obviously you don't have data there to look at, so it's all about just being as relaxed as possible. And I like to make people aware in the pool of what specific paces feel like, and trying to even split longer reps and then correlate that to the open water. On the bike as well, it's all about trying to get a progressive pacing plan, and it should feel easy for the first half of the bike and the run. If it doesn't, then the pace is going to drop 100%. You're not able to sustain a pace. If you feel like you're pushing on a little bit on the first half, then it's not going to work. But on the bike, it's also course dependent, right? So making sure that you have a pacing plan that's going to maximize speed for the course that you're doing is important. So that's the caveat against just having a progressive negative splitting pacing or effort based strategy on the bike and run. But those are the kind of key points I would probably drill home regarding pacing.
Yeah, and I think that's where in training, when you do your specific sessions, your simulation sessions, you should basically have a preliminary plan ready when you're 6-8 weeks out from the race, and then you can implement that in your training, and then you can iterate if you notice that the bike was probably a bit too hot, so my run was a bit of a struggle. Then you have more chances to practice that, and then you figure out you get it right, and you do those some of those big final big sessions, and you get it right. You know that okay, that was good, and I feel like I still had a bit more in me for an even longer day on race day. That's a really good way to approach, trying it out and figuring out through in practice that is going to work for you.
100%. You can't expect to suddenly have an extra 10% on race day, right?
Yeah, yeah, especially for Ironman, for sure. Do you have an example week in that we can chat through?
Yeah, so I chose a bit of an interesting one here. This is an athlete who was racing Challenge Roth, and they, coming from a cold environment, and although we talked about Roth being a decent race with mostly kind of cooler conditions last year, it was a hot day, and with that being a particular weakness with this athlete, I actually had some heat prep within this week, so it's a little bit more interesting. Do you want me to go through the day by day?
Go through it day by day. Yeah,
day by day, sure. So the Monday we just had an endurance swim.
Sorry, one question before that. So how many weeks out from the race is this?
This is 3 weeks to go.
Okay.
Yeah, so we had 2 weeks and then, so we had two full weeks after at the end of this week until race day.
Mm.
So Monday was an endurance swim, 3K in the morning, toys, some longer reps there, and some pool work with some paddles. And then we had a heat prep ride, which was following a pretty standard heat prep protocol where we get the temperature as high as we can for the first 10 to 15 minutes and then maintain it for 50 minutes. And this is on the turbo, layers on, fan off, and we're pushing pretty low power numbers towards the end there in order to maintain that heat stimulus. Tuesday was a heat prep run. So this was the last week of the heat prep, by the way, and this was on the treadmill, same protocol with layers, no fan on the treadmill, and that was just an hour. And then Wednesday, it was a threshold swim in the morning. Session was 12 by 200s on 3:45. And then the afternoon, we had an LT2 bike session, which was 4 minutes at 88 to 95% of FTP, and then 8 minutes at 85 to 92% of FTP, and then we were repeating that 4 times, and that was 2 hours total. Thursday was another heat prep run session, same run as Tuesday, hour on the treadmill, and then an aerobic ride in the afternoon, 90 minutes endurance. And then we had this was the last race kind of simulation type weekend. So on the Friday was a race specific swim. We had 10 400s in the pool at Ironman intensity or effort. Saturday, a 4.5 hour ride we had 2 by 45 minutes and then 2 by 30 minutes at Ironman intensity, and then a run off the bike. This was just 30 minutes Ironman pace. And then Sunday was just a run in the morning, which was a 2.5 hour run with 2 by 30 minutes and 2 by 20 minutes at Ironman effort. And then in the afternoon was a recovery swim of 3K endurance with some toys and some drills in there.
Very nice.
Total for the week was 18.5 hours of training, 15K of swimming, 9 hours of riding, and 5 hours of running.
Very good. Very good. Yeah, I also have a week, but I think that we have to skip it because we're running pretty low on time. So, but it was actually very similar volume and also volume breakdown. I'm just trying to see if there's one. I guess the week I had, it was, yeah, like your week, it was the third week out from the race. So after this week, heading into taper, the key run was 6 by 3K around race pace, basically a descend. So from slightly below race pace to slightly above race pace or build with 1K floats. So it was basically 24 kilometers of pretty solid running within a 30K run. Ended up being 2 hours, 42 minutes. And then there was a key brick session, which was a 5 hour bike with 3 by 1 hour at race pace and a 10 kilometer run at race pace, which was 53 minutes on, and that was the key break. And then further there was a bike, there was a torque session, 4x10 minutes at 85 to 90% FTP at 45 to 55 RPM. And on the swim there was a 5x800 race pace with 1 minute rest, and there was VO2 session for a little bit of sharpness and more so for technique than anything else, to be honest. It wasn't a whole lot of VO2 work, but there some 50s in short sets. And 18 hours total, 10 hour bike, 5 hour run, 3 hour swim. I don't have the meters of the swim in front of me, but probably something like 12K. So let's finish with some practical takeaways. Do you want to go first with yours? Sorry. One more thing on my week. It was also for Challenge Roth. So this was an athlete that did his first sub 10 hour Ironman and in this race. And he nailed the execution of the brick session with the paces, the powers and paces were pretty much spot on what he did on race day.
Nice. Was it, which year was that?
That was 24. So it was not last year. Yeah.
Okay. Nice. Yeah. Actually, I should caveat, and this is if we have more time, my athlete actually didn't have a good day at Roth despite the heat prep. It was the wetsuit swim, and yeah, he had a really good back end of the season, but we didn't get, even though training went really well going in, it didn't kind of come together on race day. And I think that would be one of my takeaway points is around the heat training, actually, is that I think we got that a little bit wrong. So, you know, you need to be really careful when you're looking too much at the specifics of race day. And that was one thing we did look at and one thing we felt we really needed to nail and execute. But actually, it took away from the fundamentals. And if we stray too far away, then it has a negative impact on race day. So stick to the volume and try not to get too caught up in the one percenters, I guess.
Yeah. Well, so was that one of your practical tips to close off? Yeah. Do you have anything else, or should I go with mine?
Go with yours.
Okay. So I have three of them. Well, two main ones, and then a third one for this bonus. So the first one is I already said this, but plan the progression of your long runs very systematically, very carefully. Build up so that you have adequate long runs, because I think that's important. But without having to ramp up a lot at any one point, it has to be a careful progression. And then the second one is in terms of periodization, go general to specific, but don't do too much specific in the general part, which is, so basically I'm reversing a couple of the mistakes that I talked about as common mistakes. So yeah. Then the third one, which is a bonus one, is to get your bike fit dialed, train in the position so that you can complete 180K in the TT position, because it's still amazing to me when you look at photos or videos from Ironman races, just how few people are actually sitting in their aero bars, in their TT bars. So yeah, do that. It's going to save you a ton of time on the bike if you can do that. Anything else on this topic, Jack?
No, I think that was everything. It's a great point about the bike though, to end on there for sure. That's a massive mistake, and really you can't overlook holding a decent position, because over that duration, you know, a small percentage difference in CDA or aerodynamics is going to really extrapolate and could be the difference between achieving what you want to and not so.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, then let's wrap it up there. So as usual, we have the show notes on scientifictriathlon.com. And I also want to just give a super quick reminder that it would be great if anybody listening on Spotify can take as a habit to rate the episodes, not rate the podcast, we'll do that too, with 5 stars. But we have a poll for each episode where we're asking how you liked the episode, from I loved it to I didn't like it. So that helps us really figure out which episodes that the listeners enjoy and don't enjoy so much, and keep making the podcast, improve the podcast, make it a better listener experience. So that's super helpful if you do that. Take it as a habit. It takes 2 seconds to do. It's right there in Spotify if you listen there. And if you don't, then feel free to leave comments elsewhere, whether it's on YouTube comments or wherever. But it's good to have something quantitative, and the Spotify poll allows that really easily. So that's the reason that's the platform of choice. And then, of course, remember that if you would like some help with your Ironman training, we can and would love to help you. We have coaching, ready-made and customized training plans and consultations. So there are options for different needs and budgets. And it's also important, I think we should say, Jack, that we work with athletes of all levels, right? So it's not just fast athletes, not just beginners. It's everything from the really fast athletes to athletes looking to do their first season in triathlon. Obviously, with the caveat there that you should know how to swim and bike, even if you don't do it particularly fast yet. But that's where we don't really work with athletes that don't actually know how to do that yet. And you can find more information about everything that we do on scientifictriathlon.com. And if you're interested in working with us in some capacity, then feel free to email me. I'm Michael at scientifictriathlon.com, and we can discuss these options further. And that's it. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.